When I was in rabbinical school, I went across the street from the Jewish Theological Seminary to take a class at Union Theological Seminary, one of the leading Protestant seminaries in the country. And the class I took was with Robert Handy, who was one of the great church historians of the United States, one of the great historians of religion from the moment the country was founded, in fact, even before, until the present day. And the first day of the course, Professor Handy, and this was the last year he was going to teach, which was why I was anxious to take the class, handed out a reading list, not of everything we had to read, but of everything we could read. And I looked through that list of hundreds and hundreds of books on every branch of religion, and there are a lot of them in the United States, and I marveled that any human being could have actually gotten through this list. And he began the class as follows. He said, "This is a list of books that I've read, or read about, or heard about." He said, "Because when I started my career, whatever, 50 years ago, I said to myself, I'm going to read every book in my field. After a couple of years, I said, I'm going to read every book review in my field. And I haven't even managed that." And it occurred to me that at a certain point, all of us give up. Not about reading books, but we concede that there are going to be vast areas of ignorance in our lives, and we'll never catch up. And the older you get, the greater the areas of ignorance. Because most of us, for example, at one point in our lives used to know something about popular music. But now, when my bar bat mitzvah kids say to me, when I ask them, what kind of music do you listen to, and they tell me the names of the bands, I know that they're speaking English words, and I assume that these people produce something that resembles what I would consider music, sometimes. But that's about as far as it goes, and I have given up. I've conceded that area to my ignorance. But the reverse process also happens as you get older, which is that just as you admit there are lots of things you won't know, you feel that there are things you do know that you think ought to be known by people who come after you. Okay, so I don't know anything about popular music, but let me tell you what I do know about that you don't know about, just by virtue of being older. As in Mark Twain's wonderful comment about his father, that when he was 15, his father was ignorant, but when he had gotten to be 20, he was amazed at how much the old man had learned in 5 years. Right? That you do start to recognize a wisdom that comes with memory, and you try to pass that on. I bring this up because this week I attended, as did some of you, the Israel Independence Celebration, which this year, I'm proud to say, was held here at Sinai Temple. And I looked around the room, and I realized that more people in the room had been born after the founding of the State of Israel than had been born before the founding of the State of Israel. And that they, as is the case with me, never knew a world in which there was no Israel. And therefore, those who retained the memory of what the world was like, not the knowledge, but the memory, which is different. Knowledge you get from books, but memory you can only have from life. Those who retained the memory of what the world was like had a burning desire to let the rest of us know of a world absent a Jewish state. I remember my father telling the story, which he actually once told here at Sinai Temple, of the great rally that was held in the arena in New York when the state was declared, and he, like so many others, had slept over the night before so that they could run and get front row seats. And thousands of people were gathered around the auditorium, and he and his rabbinical school colleague were standing there, and next to them was a very old man. And they said to him, do you want us to wait, and do you want us to help you, and we'll walk in with you? And he said, no, it's all right, you run, don't worry about me. And they opened the doors, and everybody poured in, and my father and his friend ran, and they got a seat in the second or third row, and sure enough, next to them was this old man. And my father said to him, how'd you do it? And he said, I did it because I wasn't running alone. He wasn't running alone because all of the people whom he remembered, his family, his ancestors, everybody who barely dreamed of a Jewish state, they were running alongside him. And that excitement, that monumental achievement, the moment when all of a sudden, after thousands of years, there was a state, that's something that those of us who come after can never know. Fifty-nine years later, there are dreams that were fulfilled and dreams that go sadly unfulfilled. We have a Jewish state. Not only do we have a Jewish state, but we have completely fulfilled one of the dreams of Ben-Gurion when he first found out at the independence celebrations in Israel about a theft that occurred during the celebrations. He said, we have our first thief, we're a normal country now. And that desire for Jews to be normal, not to be exceptional, just for a brief sliver of history, for us to be like everybody else, for a brief moment that dream was fulfilled. And in fact, if you walk the streets of Israel, much of it is true. People raise their children, send them to school, have disappointments, disagreements, anger, there is corruption, there is journalism. The two things sometimes intersect, all the normalities of a free country. But there is one great hope that Israel has not been able to fulfill. And this was a hope that animated the founding of Israel from the very beginning. Because you will recall that when Herzl first had the dream of the state of Israel, which he called, by the way, not the Jewish state, but the Jews' state, in other words, just a place where Jews could go, that it was the specter of anti-Semitism that haunted Europe at the Dreyfus trial that made him realize that the Jews of Europe would never be comfortably accepted. That despite the Napoleonic conquest and the Sanhedrin and the Enlightenment and the idea that all Jews would now be embraced, that there in the heart of the Enlightenment, in the home of Voltaire and Rousseau in France, anti-Semitism had reared its head. And so Herzl, who knew little of Judaism but had a very keen social sense, said there has to be a place for Jews to go where anti-Semitism will never disappear. But the corollary of that was, if Jews have a place to go, if they have a country, then finally, the hatred that has dogged them for thousands of years will ebb away, and we will live in comfort and in peace like all the other nations. But of course, it didn't happen that way. Now, anti-Semitism is a complicated phenomenon. And anybody who gives you a simple reason for anti-Semitism is doing a disservice to the idea, to the victims, and even to the complexity of some of the perpetrators. I've been thinking a lot about this because this Tuesday, the Lunch and Learn is going to be about the causes of anti-Semitism and whether it has cures, and I'm not going to speak about all its causes today. But it is complicated, and it has ebbed and flowed and changed all throughout Jewish history. But one thing that has not changed about anti-Semitism, remarkably enough, is that it has remained what the black critic Stanley Crouch calls a protean hatred. That is, it doesn't matter what you hate in the world, you can also hate the Jews. Let me read you a magnificent passage from a Polish critic, Konstantin Jeleński, which was published in Kultura in 1968. He's writing about his own people, the Poles. He said, "Poles have never come out against Jews because they are Jews, but because Jews are dirty, greedy, mendacious, because they wear earlocks, speak jargon, and don't want to assimilate, and also because they do assimilate, cease using their jargon, are nattily dressed, and want to be regarded as Poles. We've hated Jews because they lack culture, and because they're overly cultured, because they're superstitious, backward, and ignorant, and because they're capable, progressive, and ambitious, because they have long, hooked noses, and because it's sometimes difficult to distinguish them from pure Poles, because they crucify Christ and practice ritual murder and pour over the Talmud, and because they disdain their own religion, try to join ours, or are atheists, because they look wretched and sickly, and because they're tough and have their own fighting units and are full of chutzpah, because they're bankers and capitalists, and because they're communists and agitators, but never because they're Jews. It doesn't matter what you hate in the world. You can also hate Jews. And that ineradicable virus that takes root sometimes in places in the world where there are no Jews. Anti-Semitism in Japan, of all places. That's a mystery and a puzzle that composes what the historian Robert Wistrich called the longest hatred. And the dream that if only Jews were not powerless and wandering anymore, if they had a state, it would be over, that dream has been dashed. And instead, the most virulent, evil, corrosive stereotypes based on things like the protocols of the elders of Zion, which was conclusively proved to be a forgery over 100 years ago. Those stereotypes have now infected not just the Christian world that gave birth to them, but the Muslim world that embraces them. And so, strangely enough, Ben-Gurion's dream is upended not because people are looking to the Jews to become special. But because we are the bearers of this unique resentment. Because we are told at the same time that we are less than human and also that we are superhuman. That Jews control the world, and yet no one wants them in their own country. This realization is central to the psychology of modern Israel. Countries have enemies. As a diplomat once famously said, countries don't have friends, they have interests. And interests sometimes means interests of drawing someone close and interests of pushing someone away. And invariably, when you are the enemy of a country, the president of that country will at some point during the conflict make the following declaration. You've heard it 1,000 times. We are not the enemy of the so-and-so people. We have a quarrel with their government. I mean, how many times has America, for example, said that about Iran? The president of Iran said it about America. We have no quarrel with the American people. It's the government we don't like. And we say the same thing. We have no quarrel with the Iranian people. It's the government that we don't like. There is only one country of whom this is not said. The president of Iran never said, we have no quarrel with the Jewish people, it's the government we don't like. Because it's not true. It's not true. When you look at the United Nations, for example, which is supposed to be the great universal institution that embraces the country and government of all the world, Israel is the only country in the world that is not eligible to sit on the Security Council. Only one. Burma? Sure. Saudi Arabia? Absolutely. It's eligible. Israel has been the object of more investigative committees and special missions than any other country in the world. During the 61st session of the General Assembly in 2006 and 7, there were 22 anti-Israel resolutions. While the genocide was going on in Darfur, how many anti-Sudanese resolutions did the UN see fit to pass? Not one. Not one. Now, if you ask yourself how much of this is politics and how much of this is hatred, the answer is I can't disentangle it, but I know that it's not all politics. And so do you. It's gone on too long, been too powerful, and the sad statistics, they are too eloquent. So in the 59th year of the founding of the state, in the first time in thousands of years that Jews have had sovereignty over themselves, what is our response? First of all, it is central to recognize that anti-Semitism is not a Jewish problem. Anti-Semitism is a disorder of the anti-Semite, not of the Jew. It is the one who hates who really has the problem, not the one who is hated. Which means that, and I cannot emphasize this enough, Israel's policies might be completely wrong. They might need desperately to change the direction of the government. But if you think that it is Jewish behavior that brings on hatred, you're blind. When we were powerless in Europe, we were hated. When we are powerful in the Middle East, we are hated. It is not a disorder of the Jewish soul, it is a disorder of the non-Jewish soul. It is the one who hates over years, over centuries, over millennia, who has to look at anti-Semitism. Conferences on anti-Semitism should take place in churches and mosques, not in synagogues. Our problem Our focus should be on our own behavior, cultivating our own goodness. Their problem is their own hatred. Our problem is our resistance, and their problem is their bigotry. Our problem is maintaining a merciful strength, and their problem is recognizing how debilitating it is to always think that someone else is the cause of your own failure. I'm not recommending a policy, but I am encouraging an attitude. Realize that this is a difficult and intractable disease. And because it is so intractable, because anti-Semitism is so difficult to eradicate, people are always saying, if only the Jews would change their behavior. Because it's clear that the world hasn't made much progress in getting the anti-Semites to change theirs. But it will not work. It cannot work. It is the conscience of the world and not the conscience of the Jew that ought to rest uneasy at night. At least in regard to this. I wish that I could conclude by telling you that there is a solution, but I certainly can conclude by telling you that there is a hope. First of all, remember, if you remember or know if you were not there, that there was a time when the world was half in the grip of people whose greatest mania was for the destruction of our own people. And the idea in ancient and medieval times that Jews would live in freedom and comfort and prosperity as we do in this blessed land was inconceivable to our ancestors. And so when we look at history, we have to look at history not only for warning, but also for comfort. So our first hope is that in fact it is possible and it is true that in many ways history shows progress. Many evils of human history have been all but eradicated, including the millennial evil of slavery, which for thousands of years people took for granted. It is just not true that human beings cannot make progress, and perhaps we can in this as well. But there is another reason for hope. And the other reason for hope is from the Haftarah this morning, from the book of Amos. This is what I declare, Ne'um Adonai, says God. The mountains shall drip wine, and the hills shall wave with grain. I will restore my people Israel, and they will rebuild the ruined cities, and they will inhabit them. They shall plant their vineyards and drink their wine, and till their gardens and eat their fruits. V'lo yinatshu od, they will be planted in their land, and they will no more be plucked up. That is God's promise to the prophet. There is some slight glimmer of its realization in the world today. When I looked around that room, I saw those who were born at a time when this promise was inconceivable. That the words of Amos would begin to come true seemed impossible. When the world was plunged into the greatest torment and tragedy that it had ever known, and who would have thought that shortly afterwards the state would be born? Here the prophet knew better than the historian. And so that too is a hope. So let us teach our children this collective memory that when they travel to Israel, when they travel with their people, they do not go alone. And that old man who ran into that crowded auditorium, he knew something that is too easy to forget, which is that the hopes and dreams of our ancestors and the promise of our God should not lightly be tossed aside, even in the face of the hatred and the threats of so many, and that the prophecy still could be fulfilled. V'lo yinatshu od me'al admatam asher natati lahem amar Adonai Elohecha, that my people will be planted in the land, and they will never again leave it. So I have promised, says God. Shabbat Shalom.